Why is the ending so surprising? We made an assumption based on our fears. It is all too easy to fall into the habit of putting the worst interpretation on what the other side says or does. A suspicious interpretation often follows naturally from one's existing perceptions. Moreover, it seems the safe thing to do, and it shows spectators how bad the other side really is. But the cost of interpreting whatever they say or do in its most dismal light is that fresh ideas in the direction of agreement are spurned, and subtle changes of position are ignored or rejected. Don't blame them for your problem. It is tempting to hold the other side responsible for your problem. Your company is totally unreliable. Every time you service our rotary generator here at the factory, you do a lousy job and it breaks down again. Blaming is an easy mode to fall into, particularly when you feel that the other side is indeed responsible. But even if blaming is justified, it is usually counterproductive. Under attack, the other side will become defensive and will resist what you have to say. They will cease to listen, or they will strike back with an attack of their own. Assessing blame firmly entangles the people with the problem. When you talk about the problem, distinguish the symptoms from the person with whom you are talking. Our rotary generator that you service has broken down again. That is 3 times in the last month. The first time it was out of order for an entire week. The factory needs a functioning generator. I need your advice on how we can minimize our risk of generator breakdown. Should we change service companies, sue the manufacturer, or what? Discuss each other's perceptions. One way to deal with differing perceptions is to make them explicit and discuss them with the other side. As long as you do this in a frank, honest manner without either side blaming the other for the problem as each sees it, such a discussion may provide the understanding they need to take what you say seriously, and vice versa. It is common in a negotiation to treat as unimportant those concerns of the other side perceived as not standing in the way of an agreement. To the contrary, communicating loudly and convincingly things you are willing to say that they would like to hear can be one of the best investments you as a negotiator can make. Consider the negotiation over the transfer of technology that arose at the multinational Law of the Sea Conference. From 1974 to 1981, representatives of some 150 nations gathered in New York and Geneva to formulate rules to govern uses of the ocean from fishing rights to mining manganese in the deep seabed. At one point, representatives of the developing countries expressed keen interest in an exchange of technology. Their countries wanted to be able to acquire from the highly industrialized nations advanced technical knowledge and equipment for deep seabed mining. The United States and other developed countries saw no difficulty in satisfying that desire, and therefore saw the issue of technology transfer as unimportant. In one sense, it was unimportant to them, but it was a great mistake for them to treat the subject as unimportant. By devoting substantial time to working out the practical arrangements for transferring technology, they might have made their offer far more credible and far more attractive to the developing countries. By dismissing the issue as a matter of lesser importance to be dealt with later, the industrialized states gave up a low-cost opportunity to provide the developing countries with an impressive achievement and a real incentive to reach agreement on other issues. Look for opportunities to act inconsistently with their perceptions. Perhaps the best way to change someone's perceptions is to send them a message different from what they expect. The visit of Egypt's President Anwar Sadat to Jerusalem in November 1977 provides an outstanding example of such an action. At the time, Israelis saw Sadat and Egypt as their enemy, the man and country that had launched a surprise attack on them 4 years before. To alter that perception, to help persuade the Israelis that he too desired peace, Sadat flew to the capital of his enemies, a disputed capital that not even the United States, Israel's best friend, had recognized as the capital of Israel. Instead of acting as an enemy, Sadat acted as a partner. Without this dramatic move, it is hard to imagine the signing of an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty in 1979. Give them a stake in the outcome by making sure they participate in the process. If they are not involved in the process, they are unlikely to approve the product. It is that simple. If you go to the state insurance commissioner prepared for battle after a long investigation, it is not surprising that he's going to feel threatened and resist your conclusions. If you fail to ask an employee whether he wants an assignment with responsibility, don't be surprised to find out that he resents it. If you want the other side to accept a disagreeable conclusion, it is crucial that you involve them in the process of reaching that conclusion. This is precisely what people tend not to do. When you have a difficult issue to handle, your instinct is to leave the hard part until last. Let's be sure we have the whole thing worked out before we approach the commissioner. The commissioner, however, is much more likely to agree to a revision of the regulations if he feels that he has had a part in drafting it. This way, the revision becomes just one more small step in the long drafting process that produced his original regulation, rather than someone's attempt to butcher his completed product. During the nearly 50-year struggle against apartheid, legalized racial segregation in South Africa that ended only with the multi-party elections of 1994, white moderates at one point were trying to abolish the discriminatory pass laws. How? By meeting in an all-white parliamentary committee to discuss proposals. Yet, however meritorious those proposals might prove, they would be insufficient, not necessarily because of their substance, but because they would be the product of a process in which no blacks were included. Blacks would hear, "We superior whites are going to figure out how to solve your problems." It would be the white man's burden all over again, which was the problem to start with. Even if the terms of an agreement seem favorable, the other side may reject them simply out of a suspicion born of their exclusion from the drafting process. Agreement becomes much easier if both parties feel ownership of the ideas. The whole process of negotiation becomes stronger as each side puts their imprimatur bit by bit on a developing solution. Each criticism of the terms and consequent change, each compromise, is a personal mark that the negotiator leaves on a proposal. A proposal evolves that bears enough of the suggestions of both sides for each to feel it is theirs. To give the other side a feeling of participation, get them involved early. Ask their advice. Giving credit generously for ideas wherever possible will give them a personal stake in defending those ideas to others. It may be hard to resist the temptation to take credit for yourself, but forbearance pays off handsomely. Apart from the substantive merits, the feeling of participation in the process is perhaps the single most important factor in determining whether a negotiator accepts a proposal. In a sense, the process is the product. Face saving. Make your proposals consistent with their values. In the English language, face saving carries a derogatory flavor. People say, "We are doing that just to let them save face," implying that a little pretense has been created to allow someone to go along without feeling badly. The tone implies ridicule. This is a grave misunderstanding of the role and importance of face saving. Face saving reflects people's need to reconcile the stand taken in a negotiation or an agreement with their existing principles and with their past words and deeds. The judicial process concerns itself with the same subject. When a judge writes an opinion on a court ruling, she is saving face, not only for herself and for the judicial system, but for the parties. Instead of just telling one party, "You win," and telling the other, "You lose," she explains how her decision is consistent with principle, law, and precedent. She wants to appear not as arbitrary, but as behaving in a proper fashion. A negotiator is no different. Often in a negotiation, people will continue to hold out not because the proposal on the table is inherently unacceptable, but simply because they want to avoid the feeling or the appearance of backing down to the other side. If the substance can be phrased or conceptualized differently so that it seems a fair outcome, they will then accept it. Terms negotiated between a major city and its Hispanic community on access to municipal jobs were unacceptable to the mayor until the agreement was withdrawn and the mayor was allowed to announce the same terms as his own decision, carrying out a campaign promise. Face saving involves reconciling an agreement with principle and with the self-image of the negotiators. Its importance should not be underestimated. Emotion. In a negotiation, particularly in a bitter dispute, feelings may be more important than talk. The parties may be more ready for battle than for cooperatively working out a solution to a common problem. People often come to a negotiation realizing that the stakes are high and feeling threatened. Emotions on one side will generate emotions on the other. Fear may breed anger, and anger fear. Emotions may quickly bring a negotiation to an impasse or an end. First, recognize and understand emotions, theirs and yours. Look at yourself during the negotiation. Are you feeling nervous? Is your stomach upset? Are you angry at the other side? Listen to them and get a sense of what their emotions are. You may find it useful to write down what you feel, perhaps fearful, worried, angry, and then how you might like to feel, confident, relaxed. Do the same for them. In dealing with negotiators who represent their organizations, it is easy to treat them as mere mouthpieces without emotions. It is important to remember that they too, like you, have personal feelings, fears, hopes, and dreams. Their careers may be at stake. There may be issues on which they are particularly sensitive and others on which they are particularly proud. Nor are the problems of emotion limited to the negotiators. Constituents have emotions too. A constituent may have an even more simplistic and adversarial view of the situation. Ask yourself, what is producing the emotions? Why are you angry? Why are they angry? Are they responding to past grievances and looking for revenge? Are emotions spilling over from one issue to another? Are personal problems at home interfering with business? In the Middle East negotiation, Israelis and Palestinians alike feel a threat to their existence as peoples and have developed powerful emotions that now permeate even the most concrete practical issue, like distribution of water in the West Bank, so that it becomes almost impossible to discuss and resolve. Because in the larger picture, both peoples feel that their own survival is at stake, they see every other issue in terms of survival. Pay attention to core concerns. Many emotions in negotiation are driven by a core set of five interests. Autonomy, the desire to make your own choices and control your own fate. Appreciation, the desire to be recognized and valued. Affiliation, the desire to belong as an accepted member of some peer group. Role, the desire to have a meaningful purpose. And status, the desire to feel fairly seen and acknowledged. Trampling on these interests tends to generate strong negative emotions. Attending to them can build rapport and a positive climate for problem-solving negotiation. Consider the role of identity. Another surefire driver of strong negative emotion is a perceived threat to identity, one's self-image or self-respect. As human beings, we apply our general tendency toward either-or thinking to our self-perception. I am a kind person. I am a good manager. This sets us up to feel threatened by people pointing out our inevitable failings and inconsistencies. No one is perfect or entirely consistent about anything, but unconsciously, that can be painful and uncomfortable to accept. As a result, when confronted, we may get scared or angry as an internal debate rages about whether we are or aren't competent, lovable, fair, or whatever matters to us. If you find a counterpart's behavior oddly out of character or feel as if you have unexpectedly stepped on a landmine in your conversation, think about whether they might be experiencing a threat to their identity from something you have said or might say. Similarly, if you find yourself feeling off balance and emotional, ask yourself if your sense of identity feels threatened. Make emotions explicit and acknowledge them as legitimate. Talk with the people on the other side about their emotions. Talk about your own. It does not hurt to say, you know, the people on our side feel we have been mistreated and are very upset. We're afraid an agreement will not be kept even if one is reached. Rational or not, that is our concern. Personally, I think we may be wrong in fearing this, but that's a feeling others have. Do the people on your side feel the same way? Making your feelings or theirs an explicit focus of discussion will not only underscore the seriousness of the problem, it will also make the negotiations less reactive and more proactive. Freed from the burden of unexpressed emotions, people will become more likely to work on the problem. Allow the other side to let off steam. Often, one effective way to deal with people's anger, frustration, and other negative emotions is to help them release those feelings. People obtain psychological release through the simple process of recounting their grievances to an attentive audience. If you come home wanting to tell your husband about everything that went wrong at the office, you will become even more frustrated if he says, "Don't bother telling me. I'm sure you had a hard day. Let's skip it." The same is true for negotiators. Letting off steam may make it easier to talk rationally later. Moreover, if a negotiator makes an angry speech and thereby shows his constituency that he is not being soft, they may give him a freer hand in the negotiation. He can then rely on a reputation for toughness to protect him from criticism later if he eventually enters into an agreement. Hence, instead of interrupting polemical speeches or walking out on the other party, you may decide to control yourself, sit there, and allow them to pour out their grievances at you. When constituents are listening, such occasions may release their frustration as well as the negotiators. Perhaps the best strategy to adopt while the other side lets off steam is to listen quietly without responding to their attacks, and occasionally to ask the speaker to continue until he has spoken his last word. In this way, you offer little support to the inflammatory substance, give the speaker every encouragement to speak himself out, and leave little or no residue to fester. Don't react to emotional outbursts. Releasing emotions can prove risky if it leads to an emotional reaction. If not controlled, it can result in a violent quarrel. One unusual and effective technique to contain the impact of emotions was used in the 1950s by the Human Relations Committee, a labor management group set up in the steel industry to handle emerging conflicts before they became serious problems. The members of the committee adopted the rule that only one person could get angry at a time. This made it legitimate for others not to respond stormily to an angry outburst. It also made letting off emotional steam easier by making an outburst itself more legitimate. That's okay, it's his turn. The rule has the further advantage of helping people control their emotions. Breaking the rule implies that you have lost self-control, so you lose some face. Use symbolic gestures. Any lover knows that to end a quarrel, the simple gesture of bringing a red rose goes a long way. Acts that would produce a constructive emotional impact on one side often involve little or no cost to the other. A note of sympathy, a statement of regret, a visit to a cemetery, delivering a small present for a grandchild, shaking hands or embracing, eating together, all may be priceless opportunities to improve a hostile emotional situation at small cost. On many occasions, an apology can diffuse emotions effectively, even when you do not acknowledge personal responsibility for the action or admit an intention to harm. An apology may be one of the least costly and most rewarding investments you can make. Communication. Without communication, there is no negotiation. Negotiation is a process of communicating back and forth for the purpose of reaching a joint decision. Communication is never an easy thing, even between people who have an enormous background of shared values and experience. Couples who have lived with each other for 30 years still have misunderstandings every day. It is not surprising, then, to find poor communication between people who do not know each other well and who may feel hostile and suspicious of one another. Whatever you say, you should expect that the other side will almost always hear something different. There are three big problems in communication. First, negotiators may not be talking to each other, or at least not in such a way as to be understood. Frequently, each side has given up on the other and is no longer attempting any serious communication with it. Instead, they talk merely to impress third parties or their own constituency. Rather than trying to dance with their negotiating partner toward a mutually agreeable outcome, they try to trip him up. Rather than trying to talk their partner into a more constructive step, they try to talk the spectators into taking sides. Effective communication between the parties is all but impossible if each plays to the gallery. Even if you are talking directly and clearly to them, they may not be hearing you. This constitutes the second problem in communication. Note how often people don't seem to pay enough attention to what you say. Probably equally often, you would be unable to repeat what they had said. In a negotiation, you may be so busy thinking about what you are going to say next, how you are going to respond to that last point, or how you are going to frame your next argument, that you forget to listen to what the other side is saying now. Or you may be listening more attentively to your constituency than to the other side. Your constituents, after all, are the ones to whom you will have to account for the results of the negotiation. They are the ones you are trying to satisfy. It's not surprising that you should want to pay close attention to them, but if you are not hearing what the other side is saying, there is no communication. The third communication problem is misunderstanding. What one says, the other may misinterpret. Even when negotiators are in the same room, communication from one to the other can seem like sending smoke signals in a high wind. Where the parties speak different languages, the chance for misinterpretation is compounded. For example, in Persian, the word compromise apparently lacks the positive meaning it has in English of a midway solution both sides can live with, but has only a negative meaning as in, our integrity was compromised. Similarly, the word mediator in Persian suggests meddler, someone who is barging in uninvited. In early 1980, UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim flew to Iran to seek the release of American diplomats being held hostage by Iranian students soon after the Islamic Revolution. His efforts were seriously set back when Iranian National Radio and Television broadcast in Persian a remark he reportedly made on his arrival in Tehran. "I have come as a mediator to work out a compromise." Within an hour of the broadcast, his car was being stoned by angry Iranians. What can be done about these three problems of communication? Listen actively and acknowledge what is being said. The need for listening is obvious, yet it is difficult to listen well, especially under the stress of an ongoing negotiation. Listening enables you to understand their perceptions, feel their emotions, and hear what they are trying to say. Active listening improves not only what you hear, but also what they say. If you pay attention and interrupt occasionally to say, "Did I understand correctly that you are saying that?" the other side will realize that they are not just killing time, not just going through a routine. They will also feel the satisfaction of being heard and understood. It has been said that the cheapest concession you can make to the other side is to let them know that they have been heard. Standard techniques of good listening are to pay close attention to what is said, to ask the other party to spell out carefully and clearly exactly what they mean, and to request that ideas be repeated if there is any ambiguity or uncertainty. Make it your task while listening not to phrase a response, but to understand them as they see themselves. Take in their perceptions, their needs, and their constraints. Many consider it a good tactic not to give the other side's case too much attention and not to admit any legitimacy in their point of view. A good negotiator does just the reverse. Unless you acknowledge what they are saying and demonstrate that you understand them, they may believe you have not heard them. When you then try to explain a different point of view, they will suppose that you still have not grasped what they mean. They will say to themselves, "I told him my view, but now he's saying something different, so he must not have understood it." Then, instead of listening to your point, they will be considering how to make their argument in a new way so that this time maybe you will fathom it. So show that you understand them. "Let me see whether I follow what you are telling me. From your point of view, the situation looks like this." As you repeat what you understood them to have said, phrase it positively from their point of view, making the strength of their case clear. You might say, "You have a strong case. Let me see if I can explain it. Here's the way it strikes me." Understanding is not agreeing. One can at the same time understand perfectly and disagree completely with what the other side is saying. But unless you can convince them that you do grasp how they see it, you may be unable to get them to hear when you explain your viewpoint to them. Once you have made their case for them, then come back with the problems you find in their proposal. If you can put their case better than they can and then refute it, you maximize the chance of initiating a constructive dialogue on the merits and minimize the chance of their believing you have misunderstood them. Speak to be understood. Talk to the other side. It is easy to forget sometimes that a negotiation is not a debate, nor is it a trial. You are not trying to persuade some third party. The person you are trying to persuade is seated at the table with you. If a negotiation is to be compared with a legal proceeding, the situation resembles that of two judges trying to reach agreement on how to decide a case. Try putting yourself in that role, treating your opposite number as a fellow judge with whom you are attempting to work out a joint opinion. In this context, it is clearly unpersuasive to blame the other party for the problem, to engage in name-calling, or to raise your voice. On the contrary, it will help to recognize explicitly that they see the situation differently and to try to go forward as people with a joint problem. To reduce the dominating and distracting effect that the press, home audiences, and third parties may have, it is useful to establish private and confidential means of communicating with the other side. You can also improve communication by limiting the size of the group meeting. In the negotiations over the city of Trieste in 1954, for example, little progress was made in the talks among Yugoslavia, Britain, and the United States until the three principal negotiators abandoned their large delegations and started meeting alone and informally in a private house. A good case can be made for changing President Woodrow Wilson's appealing slogan, "Open covenants openly arrived at," to "Open covenants privately arrived at." No matter how many people are involved in a negotiation, important decisions are typically made when no more than two people are in the room. Speak about yourself, not about them. In many negotiations, each side explains and condemns at great length the motivations and intentions of the other side. It is more persuasive, however, to describe a problem in terms of its impact on you than in terms of what they did or why. "I feel let down" instead of "you broke your word." "We feel discriminated against" rather than "you're a racist." If you make a statement about them that they believe is untrue, they will ignore you or get angry. They will not focus on your concern, but a statement about how you feel is difficult to challenge. You convey the same information without provoking a defensive reaction that will prevent them from taking it in. Speak for a purpose. Sometimes the problem is not too little communication, but too much. When anger and misperception are high, some thoughts are best left unsaid. At other times, full disclosure of how flexible you are may make it harder to reach agreement rather than easier. If you let me know that you would be willing to sell your car for $15,000 after I have said that I would be willing to pay as much as $20,000, we may have more trouble striking a deal than if you had just kept quiet. The moral is, before making a significant statement, know what you want to communicate or find out, and know what purpose this information will serve. Prevention works best. The techniques just described for dealing with problems of perception, emotion, and communication usually work well. However, the best time for handling people problems is before they become people problems. This means building a personal and organizational relationship with the other side that can cushion the people on each side against the knocks of negotiation. It also means structuring the negotiating game in ways that disentangle the substantive problem from the relationship and protect people's egos from getting involved in substantive discussions. Build a working relationship. Knowing the other side personally really does help. It is much easier to attribute diabolical intentions to an unknown abstraction called the other side than to someone you know personally. Dealing with a classmate, a colleague, a friend, or even a friend of a friend is quite different from dealing with a stranger. The more quickly you can turn a stranger into someone you know, the easier a negotiation is likely to become. You have less difficulty understanding where they are coming from. You have a foundation of trust to build upon in a difficult negotiation. You have smooth, familiar communication routines. It is easier to diffuse tension with a joke or an informal aside. The time to develop such a relationship is before the negotiation begins. Get to know them and find out about their likes and dislikes. Find ways to meet them informally. Try arriving early to chat before the negotiation is scheduled to start, and linger after it ends. Benjamin Franklin's favorite technique was to ask an adversary if he could borrow a certain book. This would flatter the person and give him the comfortable feeling of knowing that Franklin owed him a favor. Face the problem, not the people. If negotiators view themselves as adversaries in a personal face-to-face confrontation, it is difficult to disentangle their relationship from the substantive problem. In that context, anything one negotiator says about the problem seems to be directed personally at the other and is received that way. Each side tends to become defensive and reactive and to ignore the other side's legitimate interests altogether. A more effective way for the parties to think of themselves is as partners in a hard-headed, side-by-side search for a fair agreement advantageous to each. Like two shipwrecked sailors in a lifeboat at sea quarreling over limited rations and supplies, negotiators may begin by seeing each other as adversaries. Each may view the other as a hindrance. To survive, however, those two sailors will want to disentangle the objective problems from the people. They will want to identify the needs of each, whether for shade, medicine, water, or food. They will want to go further and treat the meeting of those needs as a shared problem, along with other shared problems like keeping watch, catching rainwater, and getting the lifeboat to shore. Seeing themselves as engaged in side-by-side efforts to solve a mutual problem, the sailors will become better able to reconcile their conflicting interests as well as to advance their shared interests. Similarly with two negotiators. However difficult personal relations may be between us, you and I become better able to reach an amicable reconciliation of our various interests when we accept that task as a shared problem and face it jointly. To help the other side change from a face-to-face orientation to side-by-side, you might raise the issue with them explicitly. Look, we're both lawyers, diplomats, businessmen, family, etc. Unless we try to satisfy your interests, we are hardly likely to reach an agreement that satisfies mine and vice versa. Let's look together at the problem of how to satisfy our collective interests. Alternatively, you could start treating the negotiation as a side-by-side process, and by your actions make it desirable for them to join in. It helps to sit literally on the same side of a table and to have in front of you the contract, the map, the blank pad of paper, or whatever else depicts the problem. If you have established a basis for mutual trust, so much the better. But however precarious your relationship may be, try to structure the negotiation as a side-by-side activity in which the two of you, with your different interests and perceptions and your emotional involvement, jointly face a common task. Separating the people from the problem is not something you can do once and forget about. You have to keep working at it. The basic approach is to deal with the people as human beings and with the problem on its merits. How to do the latter is the subject of the next three chapters. Chapter 3. Focus on interests, not positions. Consider Mary Parker Follett's story of two men quarreling in a library. One wants the window open and the other wants it closed. They bicker back and forth about how much to leave it open. A crack, halfway, three-quarters of the way. No solution satisfies them both. Enter the librarian. She asks one why he wants the window open. To get some fresh air. She asks the other why he wants it closed. To avoid the draft. After thinking a minute, she opens wide a window in the next room, bringing in fresh air without a draft. For a wise solution, reconcile interests, not positions. This story is typical of many negotiations. Since the party's problem appears to be a conflict of positions, and since their goal is to agree on a position, they naturally tend to think and talk about positions, and in the process often reach an impasse. The librarian could not have invented the solution she did if she had focused only on the two men's stated positions of wanting the window open or closed. Instead, she looked to their underlying interests of fresh air and no draft. This difference between positions and interests is crucial. Interests define the problem. The basic problem in a negotiation lies not in conflicting positions, but in the conflict between each side's needs, desires, concerns, and fears. The parties may say, "I am trying to get him to stop that real estate development next door," or, "We disagree. He wants $300,000 for the house. I won't pay a penny more than $250,000. But on a more basic level, the problem is, he needs the cash. I want peace and quiet. Or, He needs at least $300,000 to pay off the mortgage and put 20% down on his new house. I told my family that I wouldn't pay more than $250,000 for a house. Such desires and concerns are interests. Interests motivate people. They are the silent movers behind the hubbub of positions. Your position is something you have decided upon. Your interests are what caused you to so decide. The Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty blocked out at the Camp David summit in 1978 demonstrates the usefulness of looking behind positions. Israel had occupied the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula since the Six-Day War of 1967. When Egypt and Israel sat down together in 1978 to negotiate a peace, their positions were incompatible. Israel insisted on keeping some of the Sinai. Egypt, on the other hand, insisted that every inch of the Sinai be returned to Egyptian sovereignty. Time and again, people drew maps showing possible boundary lines that would divide the Sinai between Egypt and Israel. Compromising in this way was wholly unacceptable to Egypt. To go back to the situation as it was in 1967 was equally unacceptable to Israel. Looking to their interests instead of their positions made it possible to develop a solution. Israel's interests lay in security. They did not want Egyptian tanks poised on their border, ready to roll across at any time. Egypt's interests lay in sovereignty. The Sinai had been part of Egypt since the time of the pharaohs. After centuries of domination by Greeks, Romans, Turks, French, and British, Egypt had only recently regained full sovereignty and was not about to cede territory to another foreign conqueror. At Camp David, President Sadat of Egypt and Prime Minister Begin of Israel agreed to a plan that would return the Sinai to complete Egyptian sovereignty and, by demilitarizing large areas, would still assure Israeli security. The Egyptian flag would fly everywhere, but Egyptian tanks would be nowhere near Israel. Reconciling interests rather than positions works for two reasons. First, for every interest, there usually exist several possible positions that could satisfy it. All too often, people simply adopt the most obvious position, as Israel did, for example, in announcing that they intended to keep part of the Sinai. When you do look behind opposed positions for the motivating interests, you can often find an alternative position that meets not only your interests, but theirs as well. In the Sinai, demilitarization was one such alternative. Reconciling interests rather than compromising between positions also works because behind opposed positions lie many more interests than conflicting ones. Behind opposed positions lie shared and compatible interests, as well as conflicting ones. We tend to assume that because the other side's positions are opposed to ours, their interests must also be opposed. If we have an interest in defending ourselves, then they must want to attack us. If we have an interest in minimizing the rent, then their interest must be to maximize it. In many negotiations, however, a close examination of the underlying interests will reveal the existence of many more interests that are shared or compatible than ones that are opposed. For example, look at the interests a tenant shares with a prospective landlord. 1. Both want stability. The landlord wants a stable tenant. The tenant wants a permanent address. 2. Both would like to see the apartment well maintained. The tenant is going to live there. The landlord wants to increase the value of the apartment as well as the reputation of the building. 3. Both are interested in a good relationship with each other. The landlord wants a tenant who pays the rent regularly. The tenant wants a responsive landlord who will carry out the necessary repairs. They may also have interests that do not conflict, but simply differ. For example, 1, the tenant may not want to deal with fresh paint to which he is allergic. The landlord will not want to pay the costs of repainting all the other apartments. 2, the landlord would like the security of a down payment of the first month's rent, and he may want it by tomorrow. The tenant, knowing that this is a good apartment, may be indifferent on the question of paying tomorrow or later. When weighed against these shared and divergent interests, the opposed interests in minimizing the rent and maximizing the return seem more manageable. The shared interests will likely result in a long lease, an agreement to share the cost of improving the apartment, and efforts by both parties to accommodate each other in the interest of a good relationship. The divergent interests may perhaps be reconciled by a down payment tomorrow, and an agreement by the landlord to paint the apartment provided the tenant buys the paint. The precise amount of the rent is all that remains to be settled, and the market for rental apartments may define that fairly well. Agreement is often made possible precisely because interests differ. You and a shoe seller may both like money and shoes. Relatively, his interest in the $50 exceeds his interest in a pair of shoes. For you, the situation is reversed. You like the shoes better than the $50. Hence the deal. Shared interests and differing but complementary interests can both serve as the building blocks for a wise agreement. How do you identify interests? The benefit of looking behind positions for interests is clear. How to go about it is less clear. A position is likely to be concrete and explicit. The interests underlying it may well be unexpressed, intangible, and perhaps inconsistent. How do you go about understanding the interests involved in a negotiation, remembering that figuring out their interests will be at least as important as figuring out yours? Ask why. One basic technique is to put yourself in their shoes. Examine each position they take and ask yourself why. Why, for instance, does your landlord prefer to fix the rent, in a 5-year lease, year by year? The answer you may come up with, to be protected against increasing costs, is probably one of his interests. You can also ask the landlord himself why he takes a particular position. If you do, make clear that you are asking not for justification of this position, but for an understanding of the needs, hopes, fears, or desires that it serves. What's your basic concern, Mr. Peters, in wanting the lease to run for no more than 3 years? Ask why not. Think about their choice. One of the most useful ways to uncover interest is first to identify the basic decision that those on the other side probably see you asking them for, and then to ask yourself why they have not made that decision. What interests of theirs stand in the way? If you are trying to change their minds, the starting point is to figure out where their minds are now. Consider, for example, the negotiations between the United States and Iran in 1980, shortly after the Islamic Revolution, over the release of the 52 U.S. diplomats and embassy personnel taken hostage in Tehran by student militants when the deposed Shah of Iran entered the United States for cancer treatment. The hostage-taking provoked international outrage, and the United States soon imposed sanctions, froze Iranian bank accounts, and allowed private lawsuits to target those assets. Within Iran, however, the students were seen as heroes by some and as politically useful by conservatives, who were seeking to displace more moderate elected officials. While there were a host of serious obstacles to a resolution of this dispute, the problem is illuminated simply by looking at the choice of a typical student leader. The demand of the United States was clear: release the hostages. During much of 1980, each student's leader's choice must have sounded something like this. Shall I press for immediate release of the American hostages? If I say yes, I sell out the revolution. I will be criticized as pro-American. The others will probably not agree with me, and I may lose power. If they do, and we release the hostages, then Iran looks weak. We back down to the U.S. We get nothing. No Shah, no money. We do not know what the U.S. will do. I may have to go back to class. But there is a chance that economic sanctions might end. Our relations with other nations, especially in Europe, may improve. If I say no, I uphold the revolution. I will be praised for defending Islam. We will probably all stick together. We get fantastic TV coverage to tell the world about our grievances. Iran looks strong. We stand up to the U.S. We have a chance of getting something, at least our money back. The hostages provide some protection against U.S. intervention. I remain an increasingly important political player. But economic sanctions will no doubt continue. Our relations with other nations, especially in Europe, will suffer. Inflation and economic problems will continue. There is a risk that the U.S. might take military action, but a martyr's death is the most glorious. However, the U.S. may make further commitments about our money, non-intervention, ending sanctions, etc. We can always release the hostages later. If a typical student leader's choice sounded even approximately like this, it is understandable why the militant students held the hostages so long. As outrageous and illegal as the original seizure was, once the hostages had been seized, it was not irrational for the students to keep holding them from one day to the next, waiting for a more promising time to release them. In constructing the other side's currently perceived choice, the first question to ask is, whose decision do I want to affect? The second question is what decision people on the other side now see you asking them to make. If you have no idea what they think they are being called on to do, they may not either. That alone may explain why they are not deciding as you would like. Now, analyze the consequences, as the other side would probably see them, of agreeing or refusing to make the decision you are asking for. You may find a checklist of consequences such as the following helpful in this task. Impact on my interests. Will I lose or gain political support? Will colleagues criticize or praise me? Impact on the group's interests. What will be the short-term consequences? The long-term consequences? What will be the economic, political, legal, psychological, military, etc. consequences? What will be the effect on outside supporters and public opinion? Will the precedent be good or bad? Will making this decision prevent doing something better? Is the action consistent with our principles? Is it right? Can I do it later if I want? In this entire process, it would be a mistake to try for great precision. Only rarely will you deal with a decision maker who writes down and weighs the pros and cons. You are trying to understand a very human choice, not making a mathematical calculation. Realize that each side has multiple interests. In almost every negotiation, each side will have many interests, not just one. As a tenant negotiating a lease, for example, you may want to obtain a favorable rental agreement, to reach it quickly with little effort, and to maintain a good working relationship with your landlord. You will have not only a strong interest in effecting any agreement you reach, but also one in effecting an agreement. You will be simultaneously pursuing both your independent and your shared interests. A common error in diagnosing a negotiating situation is to assume that each person on the other side has the same interests. This is almost never the case. In the 1960s, during the Vietnam War, President Lyndon Johnson was in the habit of lumping together all the different members of the government of North Vietnam, the Viet Cong resistance in the South, and their various Soviet and Chinese advisors, and calling them all collectively he. The enemy has to learn that he can't cross the United States with impunity. He is going to have to learn that aggression doesn't pay. It will be difficult to influence any such him, or even them, to agree to anything if you fail to appreciate the differing interests of the various people and factions involved. Thinking of negotiation as a two-person, two-sided affair can be illuminating, but it should not blind you to the usual presence of other persons, other sides, and other influences. In one baseball salary negotiation, the general manager kept insisting that $500,000 was simply too much for a particular player, although other teams were paying at least that much to similarly talented players. In fact, the manager felt his position was unjustifiable, but he had strict instructions from the club's owners to hold firm without explaining why, because they were in financial difficulties that they did not want the public to hear about. Whether it is their employer, client, employees, colleagues, family, or spouse, all negotiators have a constituency to whose interests they are sensitive. To understand a negotiator's interests means to understand the variety of somewhat differing interests that they need to take into account. The most powerful interests are basic human needs. In searching for the basic interests behind a declared position, look particularly for those bedrock concerns that motivate all people. If you can take care of such basic needs, you increase the chance both of reaching agreement and, if an agreement is reached, of the other side's keeping to it. Basic human needs include security, economic well-being, a sense of belonging, recognition, control over one's life. As fundamental as they are, basic human needs are easy to overlook. In many negotiations, we tend to think that the only interest involved is money. Yet even in a negotiation over a monetary figure, such as the amount of alimony to be specified in a separation agreement, much more can be involved. What does a spouse really want in asking for $1,000 a week in alimony? Certainly they are interested in economic well-being, but what else? Possibly they want the money in order to feel psychologically secure. They may also want it for recognition, to feel treated fairly and as an equal. Perhaps their partner can ill afford to pay $1,000 a week, and perhaps that is more than is actually needed. Yet the spouse will likely accept less only if their need for security and recognition are met in other ways. What is true for individuals remains equally true for groups and nations. Negotiations are not likely to make much progress as long as one side believes that the fulfillment of their basic human needs is being threatened by the other. In negotiations between the United States and Mexico, the United States wanted a low price for Mexican natural gas. Assuming that this was a negotiation over money, the U.S. Secretary of Energy refused to approve a price increase negotiated with the Mexicans by a U.S. oil consortium. Since the Mexicans had no other potential buyer at the time, he assumed that they would then lower their asking price. But the Mexicans had a strong interest not only in getting a good price for their gas, but also in being treated with respect and a sense of equality. The U.S. action seemed like one more attempt to bully Mexico. It produced enormous anger. Rather than sell their gas, the Mexican government began to burn it off, and any chance of agreement on a lower price became politically impossible. To take another example, in negotiations over the future of Northern Ireland, Protestant leaders long tended to ignore the Catholics' need for both belonging and recognition, for being accepted and treated as equals. In turn, Catholic leaders often appeared to give too little weight to the Protestants' need to feel secure. Treating Protestant fears as their problem rather than as a legitimate concern needing attention made it even more difficult to negotiate a solution. Make a list. To sort out the various interests of each side, it helps to write them down as they occur to you. This will not only help you remember them, it will also enable you to improve the quality of your assessment as you learn new information and to place interests in their estimated order of importance. Furthermore, it may stimulate ideas for how to meet these interests. Talking about interests. The purpose of negotiating is to serve your interests. The chance of that happening increases when you communicate them. The other side may not know what your interests are, and you may not know theirs. One or both of you may be focusing on past grievances instead of on future concerns, or you may not even be listening to each other. How do you discuss interests constructively without getting locked into rigid positions? If you want the other side to take your interests into account, explain to them what those interests are. A member of a concerned citizens group complaining about a construction project in the neighborhood should talk explicitly about such issues as ensuring children's safety and getting a good night's sleep. An author who wants to be able to give a great many of his books away should discuss the matter with his publisher. The publisher has a shared interest in promotion and may be willing to offer the author a low price. Make your interests come alive. If you go with a raging ulcer to see a doctor, you should not hope for much relief if you describe it as a mild stomach ache. It is your job to have the other side understand exactly how important and legitimate your interests are. One guideline is be specific. Concrete details not only make your description credible, they add impact. For example, 3 times in the last week a child was almost run over by one of your trucks. About 8:30 Tuesday morning, that huge red gravel truck of yours, going north at almost 40 miles an hour, had to swerve and barely miss hitting 7-year-old Loretta Johnson. As long as you do not seem to imply that the other side's interests are unimportant or illegitimate, you can afford to take a strong stance in setting forth the seriousness of your concerns. Inviting the other side to correct me if I'm wrong shows your openness. And if they do not correct you, it implies that they accept your description of the situation. Part of the task of impressing the other side with your interests lie in establishing the legitimacy of those interests. You want them to feel not that you are attacking them personally, but rather that the problem you face legitimately demands attention. You need to convince them that they might well feel the same way if they were in your shoes. Do you have children? How would you feel if trucks were hurtling at 40 miles per hour down the street where you live? Acknowledge their interests as part of the problem. Each of us tends to be so concerned with his or her own interests that we pay too little heed to the interests of others. People listen better if they feel that you have understood them. They tend to think that those who understand them are intelligent and sympathetic people whose own opinions may be worth listening to. So if you want the other side to appreciate your interests, begin by demonstrating that you appreciate theirs. As I understand it, your interests as a construction company are basically to get the job done quickly at minimum cost and to preserve your reputation for safety and responsibility in the city. Have I understood you correctly? Do you have other important interests? In addition to demonstrating that you have understood their interests, it helps to acknowledge that their interests are part of the overall problem you are trying to solve. This is especially easy to do if you have shared interests. It would be terrible for all of us if one of your trucks hit a child. Put the problem before your answer. In talking to someone who represents a construction company, you might say, "We believe you should build a fence around the project within 48 hours and beginning immediately should restrict the speed of your trucks on Oak Street to 15 miles per hour. Now let me tell you why." If you do, you can be quite certain that the representative will not be listening to the reasons. They have heard your position and are no doubt busy preparing arguments against it. They are probably disturbed by your tone or by the suggestion itself. As a result, your justification will slip by them altogether. If you want someone to listen and understand your reasoning, give your interests and reasoning first and your conclusions or proposals later. Tell the company first about the dangers they are creating for young children and about your sleepless nights. Then they will be listening carefully, if only to try to figure out where you will end up on this question. And when you tell them, they will understand why. Look forward, not back. It is surprising how often we simply react to what someone else has said or done. Two people will often fall into a pattern of discourse that resembles a negotiation, but really has no such purpose whatsoever. They disagree with each other over some issue, and the talk goes back and forth as though they were seeking agreement. In fact, the argument is being carried on as a ritual or simply a pastime. Each is engaged in scoring points against the other or in gathering evidence to confirm views about the other that have long been held and are not about to change. Neither party is seeking agreement or is even trying to influence the other. If you ask two people why they are arguing, the answer will typically identify a cause, not a purpose. Caught up in a quarrel, whether between husband and wife, between company and union, or between two businesses, people are more likely to respond to what the other side has said or done than to act in pursuit of their own long-term interests. "They can't treat me like that. If they think they're going to get away with that, they will have to think again. I'll show them." The question "why" has two quite different meanings. One looks backwards for a cause and treats our behavior as determined by prior events. The other looks forward for a purpose and treats our behavior as subject to our free will. We need not enter into a philosophical debate between free will and determinism in order to decide how to act. Either we have free will, or it is determined that we behave as if we do. In either case, we make choices. We can choose to look back or to look forward. You will satisfy your interest better if you talk about where you would like to go rather than about where you have come from. Instead of arguing with the other side about the past, about last quarter's costs, which were too high, last week's action, taken without adequate authority, or yesterday's performance, which was less than expected, talk about what you want to have happen in the future. Instead of asking them to justify what they did yesterday, ask, "Who should do what tomorrow?" Be concrete but flexible. In a negotiation, you want to know where you are going and yet be open to fresh ideas. To avoid having to make a difficult decision on what to settle for, people will often go into a negotiation with no plan other than to sit down with the other side and see what they offer or demand. How can you move from identifying interests to developing specific options and still remain flexible with regard to those options? To convert your interests into concrete options, ask yourself, If tomorrow the other side agrees to go along with me, what do I now think I would like them to go along with? To keep your flexibility, treat each option you formulate as simply illustrative. Think in terms of more than one option that meets your interests. Illustrative specificity is the key concept. Much of what positional bargainers hope to achieve with an opening position can be accomplished equally well with an illustrative suggestion that generously takes care of your interest. For example, in a sports contract negotiation, an agent